And once we did all that, it doesn't sound like a lot, right? Like, all right, we did a client, we did load balancers, we did a few things here and there.
Sounds like a lot.
I mean, some people are just like, oh, okay, it doesn't, you know, I guess a developer will appreciate it because it is a lot of work. And then once we did all that, we're like, all right, we're ready for Kubernetes, right? So there's like this 2-year journey of just like, Kubernetes is just in reach, but like we kind of need to do all these steps to get there. And then last year is in August when we released the beta of our Kubernetes engine.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I am joined today, as I often am, by my colleague, Ryan Donovan. Ryan, how you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing all right. How you doing, Ben?
Not bad. Spring has sprung where I am. I've had many animal interactions today. I was late to my last meeting because I was rescuing a turtle that was crossing the road. So I've done my good deed for the day.
Good Samaritan badge for the day.
We are going to be having a chat today about Kubernetes. We're going to be talking with some fine folks at Vulture who are sponsoring this episode. Ryan, you and I have talked about the K8 many times.
Yeah.
I feel like the adoption and the usage must be increasing because it comes up on a lot of the editorial we do, as well as like the pitches that are inbound.
Yeah, I think with how much cloud adoption there is and how much sort of virtual infrastructure, this is becoming more and more an easy way just to handle that infrastructure.
Yeah, especially the lift and shift. All right, so we have two great guests today, Walt and David. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, give you a quick flyover of who they are, and then we'll dive into the conversation. So Walt, David, welcome to the Stack Overflow podcast.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
My pleasure. Walt, why don't we start with you? Tell folks quickly how it is you got into software and tech and what it is you do over at Vulture.
Yeah. All right. So hello, everyone. My name is Walt Ribeiro, and I am the developer advocate at Vulture. So the way that I got started was probably back in 2010, I started writing C++ on my Arduino. I was trying to, you know, just write some code with a bunch of like pianos and just trying to like MIDI hack them. Then I started doing a lot of like music production. And then when I came back around in about 2018, 19, at the height of the pandemic, probably about a year, maybe about 2 years ago, I just doubled down. Then I just started writing more and more code because it was the only thing to pretty much do.
Stuck at home being a creative technologist.
I like it. Yeah. Then I was the developer advocate at Linode, and I, you know, jumped around and I did a lot of software stuff for different companies. And then Vulture reached out to me, and I've been here for about a year now, and it's been awesome. I love the stack. I love the people here. I think that where the company's headed and what they've built, you know, even the things that David's built, I'm super bullish on. It's pretty much where I am today. I just do a lot of audio, a lot of video production work, and a lot of coding. That's pretty much it.
David, welcome to the program. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the world of software, and yeah, what it is you find yourself doing day-to-day at Vulture.
Sure. So hi, everyone. My name's David Dimko. So how did I get into programming? I think it started late 90s, early 2000s. I kind of became obsessed with like computer games. And it was just basically me kind of being obsessed with like Counter-Strike and like starting to mess around with like putting graphics cards in my computer, trying to get, you know, better graphics, stuff like that. And then kind of led me down into like, I love Counter-Strike, so I want to make a clan. I need a website. So it was just kind of like this really nerdy kind of like, oh, this is a computer and I can do things with it. And kind of like, it just evolved from there, right?
We get that a lot from guests.
Yeah, that's a story we hear a lot. Folks who've been on the podcast, they built forums for Tony Hawk Pro Skater 6. They were into Neopets. You know, they were into MySpace, and they wanted to customize it, to change it, to be part of a group, to organize a community. And that's kind of what led them on the path. So I love hearing that story.
Yeah, so it was mostly around computers and Counter-Strike. Then I kind of fell out of it around high school. You know, I just kind of fell out of computers. But then when I went to college, kind of got back into it, computer science degree, traditional type of path there. And after that, I kind of jumped around from a few organizations here and there. A more notable company was at Vonage, and that's kind of where I got exposed to a lot of API design and cloud native type of work. So after a while being at Vonage, kind of honing my skills there, I eventually came over to Vulture with a clear vision to kind of focus on building out a managed Kubernetes product for Vulture.
Just quickly for listeners who are not familiar, can you give me a couple sentences? Like, what is Vulture? How would you describe it? And, you know, where does it fit into the marketplace for what's being offered to developers these days.
So where we fit is that Vultr wants to be pretty much the best of services for all these different developers. So we have, you know, like we have our own block storage, but you can also, we have a lot of partners that have block storage too that we actually work with. We have, you know, a ton of great locations too. We have our custom ISO. So there are a lot of unique features that Vultr has that others don't. You know, we just like to be the best of breed for people. I mean, even our marketplace is filled with a lot of great apps. And on top of the things that David's built, like our like API and our open source projects and our load balancers. So that's pretty much where Vultr stands, because in some sense, it's sort of a like commodity, but there are some like unique prospects that we have that people depend on and that we just like to be sort of like the best of breed for all of those different products.
You mentioned sort of a wide spectrum of things and being best of breed, but like just briefly in one sentence, like what are people coming to you for top level?
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of just a quick, like one sentence is we have the best price to performance for all of our product offerings.
So we opened talking about a lot of people are getting more and more familiar with Kubernetes, but you're building out a managed Kubernetes at scale. What's the difference there?
That's a good question, because that's something we kind of learned the hard way. And I think every kind of cloud provider kind of learned this, right? So me coming to Vultr, I knew Kubernetes. I knew how to work with it. So I was pretty confident, right? But once you need to abstract the complexity and offer a managed product that removes, I want to say all the headache because there's still YAML, right? But a big chunk of that is a very unique problem that we had to solve for. For example, you know, a lot of tools that people are used to are like kubeadmin or kubespray, where they're kind of building these things and you kind of have access to everything. But on a managed platform, we remove the control plane. Like you don't have access to it. You don't know how it runs, where it runs, and you're not really concerned about it. It gives you that freedom and flexibility to kind of focus on your workloads and only your workloads. And you don't have to care about the underlying infrastructure. So there were a lot of challenges and interesting problems that we kind of faced on, okay, how do we remove that abstraction? How do we do upgrades? How do we maintain your X509 certs so you can have HTTPS kind of on your cluster? So there was a lot of unique problems that I guess I didn't account for, because I'm like, oh, I know Kubernetes, right? I use it every day. And then it's just like, there's a huge difference between managing it, using it, and then as a cloud provider, offering it that kind of abstracts all of those kind of pain points. So the journey there was quite interesting.
Because like Kubernetes seems like it's already abstracting the infrastructure. This seems like it's another level up, right?
Yeah. So, you know, with Kubernetes, you're kind of treating your entire cloud infrastructure as one solid compute. So, you know, you kind of write YAML and you can interact with, you just don't care how many instances you have, or if you want block, you kind of just tell Kubernetes you want block and it does all that for you. But for us, you know, we had to integrate with a lot of these solutions. So for example, for block storage, we had to integrate with the container storage interface. And that's a plugin that allows Kubernetes to work with Vultr as a first class citizen in regards to block. The same thing for load balancers or worker nodes. You know, we had to integrate with the CCM so that Kubernetes knows that it's running on Vultr and it knows how to interact with these resources. Now, the biggest abstraction we kind of had to do was the control plane, because you're not concerned about where the API server is or where the scheduler is running or the controller manager. Like that's all abstracted to you. Like you don't even have access to it. So when you're executing these kubectl commands, we supply a kubeconfig, but you don't really, it's going to a black box inherently. So some interesting problems there were you don't have access to that box. So how does something like kubeproxy, which is what kind of handles the IP rules under the hood, work? Because in our current setup, we're not running these as, you know, containerized services on the control plane. And that was an interesting problem because, you know, you look online for kubeadmin or all these tools and everyone's like, you use kubeproxy, it runs as a container. And it's like, we're not, we're solving for a different problem. So there were these tools that I've never heard of, something like connectivity, which allows you to kind of proxy to these containers. So if you want to use like kubemetrics or extend the API server, the control plane, which is this isolated service, has to be able to communicate back to the worker nodes through these API calls. And that was a very interesting problem to solve for, because it's almost undocumented. Everyone's just like, you use kubeproxy, and it's like, but we can't. So that was an interesting, one of the bigger ones we solved along with like X509 certs and etcd backup, stuff like that.
So yeah, you had mentioned to me, David, in an earlier conversation that on this journey to sort of bring Kubernetes and manage Kubernetes at scale to Vultr, you ended up doing quite a lot of work on API and V2 of the API. Can you talk a little bit about how that journey went?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, like I came on board and the whole concept or the whole reason was like, we want managed Kubernetes. So I'm like, okay, that's great. So we started looking into it and it's like, we boiled it down to like, what's the bare minimum we need to start with? And we kind of looked at it like, okay, we need the CCM and we need the CSIs as core components to kind of even consider to have Vultr be a first-class citizen on a Kubernetes cluster. So we built the Go client, which, hey, we have a Go client. Why don't we open source this? And then that kind of snowballed from there. It's because we had this Go client and it's like, hey, you know what? Like, we can start integrating with Terraform and Packer and write our own CLI and start integrating and basically adopting and embracing open source, which we didn't do before that. So that was like step one in the journey, right? We took a detour to build out our open source. And kind of one reason for that too is as a cloud provider, we're offering infrastructure and we're offering these abstractions, but we also want to allow any user to interact with us as many ways possible. So if you want to use the API, great. If you want to use the UI, awesome. But maybe you want to automate everything with Terraform or other kind of tools. So that was a really kind of good stopgap because it allowed us to kind of give back to the open source, but also open these avenues up for developers to interact with Vultr in more meaningful ways that for them. After that, the next step was, you know, we need a load balancer. One of the things with Kubernetes is you need to have some kind of IP address that allows for ingress. You can use node ports or other solutions, but they're not that great for scaling. So we needed a load balancer and we didn't offer managed load balancers. So that kind of led us down another detour where, hey, we need managed load balancers. Let's build this product, which is we need it for Kubernetes and load balancers are great. And similar issues there. You know, I've used load balancers in the past. And I think that's one interesting thing as a cloud provider is we've all used cloud providers and you don't think how a load balancer works. You kind of just deploy one, you hook it up and you're good to go. And it's completely different when you're a cloud provider and you're offering it because it's like, how does this work? You kind of have to you have to go back to like these basics of like how load balancing works and stuff and offer that. After that, we integrated with the CCM and the CSI. And at this point, like all these integrations, one thing that always kind of stuck with me and kind of bothered me a bit was our API, our V1. It was a product of its time. It worked, but there were a lot of things that left to be desired. So after that, we kind of decided like before we go and start doing managed Kubernetes, we should probably overhaul our API to a V2 and modernize it a bit with modern CRUD actions, pagination, RESTful design, something that, you know, a developer who would use an API would come to expect in today's day and age. So we did that. And then another detour, we had to update all of our tooling and kind of adopt this new API and have that be the basis for everything moving forward. And once we did all that, it doesn't sound like a lot, right? Like, all right, we did a client, we did load balancers, we did a few things here and there.
Sounds like a lot.
I mean, some people are just like, oh, okay, it doesn't, you know, I guess a developer will appreciate it because it is a lot of work. And then once we did all that, we're like, all right, we're ready for Kubernetes, right? So there's like this 2-year journey of just like, Kubernetes is just in reach, but like we kind of need to do all these steps to get there. And then last year is in August when we released the beta of our Kubernetes engine.
It's funny, we've done posts about scope creep, and this seems like not scope creep, but realizing what the scope actually is.
Yeah, David, were you getting feedback internally from other developers who, like you, had ideas of what it would be like to work on? Was it coming from customers? Like you're kind of describing, as Ryan said, starting out with an idea and realizing all of the different features or components or approaches or technologies that you'd need to build in for this to be a great experience when it finally kind of comes to market. So where was all that input coming from and how are you making the decisions about what to build and what not to?
It was a bit of both. It was internally, we kind of saw the need, for example, like Terraform. Like we saw that infrastructure as code and this Terraform thing is picking up speed and like we probably should do it. So it was a bit of that where like, we're kind of realizing like, oh, if we have this Go client, then we can also do these three things, right? It was just this realization of us kind of connecting the dots, like we need this. Oh, but wait, if we're going to do this, it kind of hooks it all up. And it was also customer feedback, right? Like our customer support is pretty good because we encourage Vulture users to give us feedback. And that's one thing I think is really good, because in any of our product launches, we always kind of release it as a beta and encourage users to try it and give us feedback. That way we can get really good feedback and have this iterative loop of like what users actually want. Because sometimes it's hard to gauge if they want a specific feature for a specific product, or if something we implemented just isn't working the way we thought it would. So it's a blend of both, really. And even now with something like Kubernetes, I don't have all the answers. And especially now in a cloud native-y space, users' workloads are so varied, right? So it's really good to have like these open channels of communication. We try to dog food as much of our own product as we can, because that definitely shows us any kind of pain points. So like, I'm using a load balancer VKE and there's just something that's just really getting under my skin, chances are it's not just me. So having that feedback loop is definitely internal and external for us.
Very cool. Yeah, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. It's a interesting place to be in. And I guess it feels like we end up here a lot because of, I think, the nature of our clientele, which is like folks who are themselves developers building for other developers or people who need great software products. But you know, it can be challenging to dog food. It can also be, I don't know if you've heard of this little company called AWS, but you know, like sometimes the thing you build internally ends up being, you know, quite amazing in the marketplace itself. So let's move on a little bit. I guess, you know, what's fascinating to me about this story is the evolution and the path it led you to. You mentioned, you know, the API and what you learned about that. For open source, you know, you mentioned going more in that direction. What drives that? Is that, again, sort of understanding that you're going to get more developers and momentum and attention? Is that flexibility or hope that it will improve sort of the speed of innovation and evolution? When you look at open source and considering whether or not that belongs in your organization, what are the pros and cons, and what ultimately did you decide?
I think it boils down to, if I take a step back, I am kind of approaching this with like a developer mindset, right? So like if I'm a developer, yeah, and there's like a new tool like Terraform or Packer or CLI, like I want those tools at my disposal. And like, I guess I'm selfishly, like if there's like a tool I want to use or it doesn't have like a good open source project or a client, I'm inclined not to really use it. The open source allows developers to become more creative, and it also allows that quicker, I guess it's the flexibility, because we have a Node.js client alongside a Go client, right? So if we have a JavaScript developer who wants to get really creative with our API, they don't have to make these direct API calls. They can just use our JavaScript client. Or, you know, if I'm building some kind of automation tool that's cross-cloud, then having Terraform or these infrastructure as code tools available to them, to me, it allows developers to become more creative and open up avenues to how to interact with us. If we just have a UI, that's good for a large use case, but having that API and a lot of these open source tools allows for flexibility and integrations that may otherwise not have been available.
We've talked to other folks who have open sourced from within companies. Did you run into roadblocks? Any people saying like, let's not share our secrets?
Not really. We haven't really encountered that yet. We have an example of this one tool that we kind of used internally that we ended up open sourcing. Although now it's like, there's no need for it because of our managed Kubernetes engine. But at the time, we really wanted to test our CCM and our CSI version updates, right? Just to make it easy. And spinning up a Kubernetes cluster by hand, I don't think that's fun. I don't think anyone enjoys that. So we built this Terraform module called Condor. The pun is intended, where you could just define a Kubernetes cluster and it would build it on Vulture. That was fun to do because it was a good stopgap, because it's like, we're building managed Kubernetes. We're not there yet, but we have Terraform, and we built this open source library module for Terraform that will spin up a Kubernetes cluster for you right now on Vulture as you're kind of waiting for the managed solution. So we ended up, you know, that's kind of dead now because of managed Kubernetes. But at the time it was fun because that was something we built internally and open sourced it for the users.
I think what you said to me also kind of stood out as the engineering mindset. You know, if you buy a car or a computer, as you got started with the graphics cards, you want to be able to open it up and tweak it if you decide to go in a certain direction. And you want that feedback loop to exist between you and the product, where if you need to build an integration or you feel like there's something you can improve, that's where open source really empowers the developer. And so they're more likely to adopt those tools. And it feels like increasingly that plays a key role in what, you know, wins out in the marketplace, all other things, you know, pricing, availability, performance being equal.
Definitely.
So you built out the huge, you know, all the backend stuff, the load balancer, the managed Kubernetes. Once you had it on the market, what things did customers sort of drive forward?
Our initial launch of VKE, we completely, again, this is just, there's a difference between using it and offering it. So our first beta launch, like, users quickly realized, like, hey, you're missing this crucial aggregation layer. And I'm just like, we're what? So that was one thing.
That's we're why just you have like, a beta.
Yeah. So I'm just like, I was freaking out because I'm just like, oh my God, we forgot the aggregation layer. So the clusters worked, except if you wanted to install any kind of API extension tooling, it just didn't work. So that was like the first thing that, if we didn't have that feedback loop, I probably would have realized it way after the fact. But after that, we're still getting, you know, a lot of feedback, like, you know, we want more specific regions, because when we originally launched, we only had a few. As of today, we're in almost every region. And then it's a lot of, you know, feature requests like, hey, you don't have a cluster autoscaler. So like, okay, we see the need for us to integrate with the Kubernetes autoscaler. Or, hey, like, how can I upgrade? And this is a big pain point. How can I upgrade my cluster? Well, you're going to have to deploy a new one and kind of port over your block storage. So it's a lot of the things we got back is mostly around maintenance and how a user can keep their cluster going without having to spin up a new one. So availability and upgrades are two of the big ones we're kind of focused on right now and getting out.
In terms of that whole like feedback loop, there's a lot of like social media feedback that I get that I pass on to him and his team, which is, I mean, it's one thing to get the feedback like internally or from the actual like developers, but then there's just, you know, there's some, you know, talk that I might see and then I'll just like pass it on. When I first started at Vulture, it was like my like first week, I just turned and said, so who's this like huge team that's building like our whole like Kubernetes engine and our like API? And then it turns out it was just like David and like two other people. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like crazy. So I mean, I'm impressed both from the outside looking in and then, you know, now that I'm here to see that it was a like small team, something that's, I'm just used to seeing a bunch of, you know, like pair programming kind of things within like different companies. And so he does a lot. And, you know, in terms of like our like API or our Kubernetes engine or our open source stuff, you know, I think that having that whole feedback loop and the fact that it's a smaller team is actually what helps us out a lot. It keeps us quick.
David, Walt, what are you excited for on the roadmap? You know, we talked about, you know, what customers are asking for, the things that you've built. You know, to the degree that you can, let us know things that are coming or things you've announced that you're excited about. You know, what is 2022 going to hold for Vulture?
The big thing for on my part is location, location, location. So when I first started, we had 16 locations. We're now at 25. And as David said, you know, we're in pretty much like every region. We just opened up a location in Mumbai last week, and we have no plans to stop. So we're at 25 right now. And we, you know, continue just to keep on growing that part of it too. Because the closer that we can get to the actual fingertips of our users, just to, you know, lower the ping time or, you know, just to have just a better feature set is a big part of what I think pretty much like differentiates us from many others. And so, of course, there's our products too. But in terms of like how I feel with, you know, where we're headed for 22 and 23, our locations is a big part of it.
David, anything you want to shout out before I head us out to the outros?
So, as I mentioned earlier, as of actually yesterday we enabled our Kubernetes engine in 22 locations from the original 6 or 7 we had. I forget what number it was. So people will be pleased to see that. And in the coming weeks, I guess we have been kind of teasing it. Upgrades are coming. Users won't have to be deploying duplicate clusters anymore. So VKE upgrades for Kubernetes versions is coming out soon. So I'm sure that will be a great hit.
All right, everybody, it is that time of the show. We are going to give a shout out to the winner of a Lifeboat badge. That's somebody who came on Stack Overflow. They went to a question that had a score of -3 or less. They gave it an answer, and the answer now has a score of 20 or more, and that question has a score of 3 or more. So they saved some knowledge from the dustbin of history. awarded yesterday to Givi, G-I-V-I. How can I use the Singleton pattern in an Android development project? All right, if you're curious to know more about Android development and singletons, we have some knowledge for you. Thanks for listening, everybody. I am Ben Popper. I am the director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can always find me on Twitter at Ben Popper. If you have questions or suggestions about the programming on the podcast, shoot us an email, podcast@stackoverflow.com. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a rating and a review. It really helps.
I'm Ryan Donovan. I edit the blog here at Stack Overflow. You can find me on Twitter at rthordonovan. And if you have a great idea for a blog post, please email me at pitches@stackoverflow.com.
Yeah, so my name is Walt Ribeiro again, and you can find me on Twitter at Walt Rib, because no one knows how to spell my last name. So I used to have the Walt Ribeiro handle, and then I changed it to Walt Rib. And just to find out more about what we offer, you can just go to vultr.com. That's VULTR.com. From there, you can find all of our products and our offerings there.
And again, my name is David Dimko. You can find me on Twitter at ddimko. That's D-Y-M-K-O. And if you have any questions or concerns about Kubernetes, feel free to tweet at me or just drop a support ticket, I guess. Thanks.
Yes. Everybody who listens to this show, please drop David a support ticket.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you soon.